In this episode of Tim Talk, we're talking about compassionate leadership and the role it plays in improved mental health.
Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Tim Talk. While I enjoy all the guests we have on this show and the topics we cover, this one is very near and dear to me personally, as it concerns leading with compassion and empathy. Our guest today is global health activist, author, and American healthcare executive, Donato Tramuto. Donato, thank you for being here today.
Thank you for that very warm and kind introduction. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I thank you for having me.
Could you start by, since we're really addressing healthcare access is one thing that we're talking about today, could you tell us a little about your work with the Tramuto Foundation, as well as your role as a board member of RFK Human Rights?
Yes, and I think it's probably important. I have a saying, nobody cares what you do until they know why you do it. And I think it's important to know the why of the foundation. I was planning to join my two friends and their three-year-old son, who were staying with my partner and I at our home in Ogunquit, Maine, the weekend of September 8th, 2001. And during that weekend, we went back and forth, and we decided that we would travel together on September 11th. I made that trip so many times because my company was based in Santa Monica, California. But on Monday, September 10th, I woke up with a severe toothache, and I was speaking at a conference that week in California. And so I decided to go visit my dentist in Boston. While there, I decided, gosh, I'm near Boston Airport. Why not leave Monday night? If you remember, at that time, you could just walk up and change your ticket and do anything you wanted to do. And so I called my friends, and they had said, listen, we've changed our flight once for you. We're not going to change it again. Long and short, I went out September 10th. They went out September 11th, but they lost their lives on September 11th. And rather than have bitterness and hatred in my heart, my partner and I decided that we would do something that would represent good. And so we launched the Tramuto Porter Foundation in the fall of 2001. And over the last 21 years, we have fed children. We have developed healthcare access programs in, you know, countries outside the United States. Here in the United States, we have established with the Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights a workplace dignity program to help address bullying in the workforce. We have provided each year, you know, a range of 2 to 10 scholarships. We now have endowed scholarships at 4 different colleges and universities, one at St. Joseph's College in Maine. And our goal is to make the world a more compassionate and just place. And so out of tragedy, out of sadness, out of a horrible event, we found our path forward in trying to do good. The Robert F. Kennedy Human Rights, I was fortunate to have been appointed to the board many, many years ago. I know the Kennedy family. Robert Kennedy was a hero of mine. And I love the way he transformed his life. Talk about immense tragedy in the loss of his brother, President Kennedy, and his ability to do some good. You know, I always say Robert Kennedy did not start off his life as a civil rights leader, but he died a civil rights leader. And so my point is, you can take tragedy, and that was my first book titled Life's Bulldozer Moments, How Adversity Can Lead to Success in Life and Business. And I think in my my role as a compassionate leader, I've tried to practice the definition of compassionate leadership, which is empathy in action. And so that's what the foundation, I mean, there's more I could talk about with the foundation. If anyone is interested, they can certainly get on the website. But we've been active for the last 22 years.
That's great. And you know what, that story connected with me so closely, because at that time period, 9/11, I was on a traditional hospital you know, sort of career path, hospital leader career path. And when that happened, over the next couple of years, I just thought, am I going to stay on this traditional hospital safe career path when the rest of the world, I thought, could really benefit from seeing American ingenuity in action, American caring in action, American can-do mindedness, and a little bit of, frankly, fearlessness that we weren't going to let the bad guys rule our lives. And we're going to do something good out of this, which is what I heard you say. And that's a very, very close story.
Well, I thank you for that. And I would give everything I have to not necessarily be on the public stage and to have my friends here today. But destiny had something else in mind. And, you know, a lot of times when you do these types of things, launch a foundation or write a book, you do put yourself out there. And it's the last, you know this, you're a public figure, you're doing a lot of good. Nobody, I think, in their right state of mind looks for that kind of public attention. However, in order to do the good that we had envisioned in 2001 to really help address that the world is not bad, that the world, I believe, has more kinder and compassionate folks in it, we had to do something. And when I look back at the last 21 years and I just, the letters that I received, I just received a letter last week from a young, actually a Maine-based student who wrote to us and said, without the support of the foundation, by the way, it's not just a scholarship. We provide mentoring. And, you know, I always say, you know, Jeff and I don't have any children, but we have hundreds of kids out there that have gone through the program and the letters that they write and the mentoring services that they embrace. It really has been a wonderful journey. And while I am still, I think, in pain, you know, because of the loss, the pain does get easier with each year by your helping people.
Yeah, very true. And, you know, it made me think as we're talking just now, just the whole idea of leadership and leadership style. And when I, you know, as I listened to your story and retold a little bit of mine in a condensed version, I was thinking, now, was I a compassionate and caring leader? I always thought I was, always. And I thought that was my way of showing my humanity. But was it a weak management style, leadership style, or a strong leadership style? I'm not sure if I implemented it, if I lived it that way. Now, I feel, oh my God, it is the strongest leadership style you could have, is to be a compassionate and caring leader. How do you... What do you think of that?
Well, it's a great question. And during the years that I was in a CEO position, I had my colleagues who would challenge me and say that compassionate leadership is weak and you need to be strong as a CEO. That's rubbish. In the book, I devote an entire chapter to a theory that I adopted called the three T's. And the three T's stand for the following. You start off with tenderness to get the trust, and then you can be tough. Too many leaders start off with toughness and then they go around with the pooper scooper to get the trust. I can make tough decisions. I've had to make tough decisions. A case in point, a few years ago, I was walking in, you know, the village of Algonquin. And as I was walking, somebody yelled out, "Donato, Donato," and I didn't know who it was. And so the person who was yelling out my name could see that I didn't recognize them. And she said, "Don't worry, you fired me when you were at United Health." And I said to myself, this is going to be a good day. But she said, no. She said, you did it with kindness and empathy and compassion, and you helped me transition into a totally different, you know, industry. And it was the best thing for me. And so it made me feel good that, yes, you can make tough decisions. However, you can do it by starting first with the tenderness, to get the trust, because once you have that trust, then the person has an obligation, has a responsibility to embrace that the decision you are about to make with them is one that's coming from a good place. And so I believe that we have done it, you know, in opposite venues, and it hasn't worked. And I think that if we can just, you know, approach it from hearing the stories of other people, you know, people don't realize this, but 99.5% of our DNA is identical. It's that very small element that makes us different. If we just took the time, look at you and I today. I heard you're going to Italy. You know my love for Italy. We have a home in Florence. We're connected now. We have something in common. And so we're not taking the time to listen to understand the stories of other people. And that is the compassionate leadership that we discuss about in the book, is really listening to stories and listening to understand the dynamics of the other person.
Yeah, so true. And you know what, I use a nautical term, whether it's appropriate or not, or apt or not, and that is fills my sails. You know, I listen to the stories of my staff. I'd rather listen to their stories than share my own. And I hear their stories all the time. Some might break your heart. Most of them fill you with pride. And it's just amazing. So, of course, a lot of that is based on the pandemic experience. So let me ask you a question based on now with what you just said, put in the context of the global pandemic and the response and the aftermath, especially, which, again, I believe is the most difficult phase of this pandemic, you know, 3-4 year era that we're in right now, is right now. Do you think that the global pandemic was a good thing for the movement to work? Did it make leaders more compassionate or less so?
I think it made them more compassionate. And by the way, you know, it didn't move every single leader. However, I think that even before the pandemic, we were heading for a tsunami of change. The George Floyd incident that happened, the, you know, global warming and the tension that occurred, you know, with, you know, half of our population believing that there is no global warming, the other half believing that there is. And, you know, the young generation realizing that we have a responsibility to save the planet. The racial, you know, and social unrest that, you know, 50 years ago when I was just a teenager, we were witnessing such enormous instability in our country. And here we are 50 years later, and the very issues that Dr. King and Robert Kennedy and other leaders fought for, we are fighting for them still today. Now, you pile on top of that the pandemic, but you also pile on top of that the workforce is made up of five generations. And the average age of the CEO today is 59 years old. By the way, that's the same average age of our elected officials in Washington. The Gen Zers and the millennials are representing about 45% of our employment population. And so they are asking for something different. So I think the pandemic served as what I call an immediate catalyst to say, we must change. It was already happening. You know, people were leaving the workforce. People were starting to question about what they wanted to do with their lives. But that put it on steroids. And so if the option today of a leader is to say, I'm going to ignore it, I don't think that's going to work. Because I could tell you, when I was starting off in my professional career, my parents would tell me, be seen and not heard. The young generation want to be seen and they want to be heard. And so if we're not paying attention, and you know, Tim, I don't know whether it was just coincidence that I chose this mission of compassionate leadership for my book. I should add, I didn't know if you're aware of this, that we also applied for the national calendaring of compassionate leadership, which we didn't think we would get. But the foundation was awarded it every second week of September. Again, kind of coincidental that it will tie into September 11th. But every second week of September, it will appear on the calendar. And 20,000 organizations apply for this, only 20 receive it. What does that tell you? There is a thirst right now for a new type of leadership. And so I do think the pandemic put it on steroids. I think it really elevated the awareness. A lot of CEOs are leaving their positions. And I think it's because they realize that there's a whole new change that you cannot just stand on your soapbox and say, it's going to be done this way. It's going to have to involve now inclusion. It's going to have to involve listening. And it's going to have to, quite honestly, involve a little bit of vulnerability on your end.
Yeah, so true. And vulnerability, I use the term, embrace your imperfections, but, just show your humanity. And I think that's very, very true along those lines. And by the way, these podcasts started right after the George Floyd murder. And I woke up literally at 2:30 in the morning, a couple of days later, because an employee sent me an email saying, you need to say something about this, take a position on this, take a stand, we want to hear from you. And in the past, a lot of healthcare people wouldn't weigh in on social kind of things at all. And I thought, well, this makes sense, though, for our workforce, and I'm hearing it from our workforce. So we weighed in and said, obviously, this is what we stand for. And then another employee would get back to me and say, yes, so what? So what are you going to do about it? And so the 2:30 in the morning wake up was, we're going to have this, we're going to create a dialogue forum. And so this is like our 50th forum or somewhere around there. That thank you for being our guest today. And part of that, it's based on social and medical justice. And so our whole diversity, equity, and inclusion movement started then. And there's a lot of things we've done in really fun ways, and ways to recruit better, ways to retain better, ways to listen to people better, ways to, embrace people's uniqueness. In fact, I have right behind me, a collage of individuals that work within our health system who joined us recently or now have a greater voice because some of them would say, it's tough to be invisible, feel invisible. But now I don't feel like I'm invisible anymore. And they're a part of our diversity, equity, inclusion movement at every one of our 10 hospitals and home care and hospice. So it's and as far as the next gens that you talked about, it is a very important thing for them that they're part of an organization that cares along this. Yes.
Well, two things that struck me as you were talking. Number one, you are truly a compassionate leadership. We extracted out of the 41 leaders that we interviewed, what is the definition for compassionate leadership? And it's empathy in action, and hats off to you. You saw a need during the pandemic. You saw a need after George Floyd's unfortunate murder, and you did something. And that's what compassionate leadership is. It's no longer good enough to have empathy. It's no longer good enough to say, I feel your pain, Tim. Good luck to you. You must do something. The other is, I just want to call you out. One of the lines that I have referenced in the book is that you rent your titles. You own your character. A good friend of mine once said, ability is what gets you at the top. Character is what keeps you there. And I don't care what titles I have had in my lifetime. I have been a CEO. I was an elected official in the town of Algonquin. I have been an author. None of that makes one difference to me. I am the same person today that I was 60 years ago. And so I think for those who are listening is that we have a wonderful opportunity to leave a legacy. And so many times when I had my executives in my office, I would ask them, what do you want your legacy to be 4 years, 3 years from now? And they would say to me, Donato, in all fairness, I'm only 29. I said, yes. I said, what do you want your legacy to be 3 or 4 years from now? Because your legacy is going to change. And I think that's what we have to encourage individuals to challenge themselves, because there's nothing more frustrating than a good potential. We all have the potential to be better than what we are. I am 67 years old, soon to be 67. I challenge myself every single day. I'm not perfect. I've made mistakes along the way. I'm sure I make mistakes every day around what compassionate leadership is all about. However, I'm willing to acknowledge where those mistakes are. No one beats themselves up more than myself. And that is what compassionate leadership, it's the desire and willingness to self-reflect and understand that compassionate leadership can be taught. However, your title is not what should define you. Your character is what should define you.
Very true. I love that. You rent your titles and you own your character. And that is so true. So listeners, I hope you really caught hold of that idea, because it's more than an idea. It's a way of life. Thank you. Donato, I'd like to pivot a bit to mental health, because it's such a, it is today's pandemic, and, you know, in all of healthcare, not only in the state of Maine, but really across the country, I believe that one of the, if not the worst, condition that has left to get even worse is mental health for, you know, those individuals that really need specialized care. They need a bed in a facility with the care team around them, and really work on a longer term solution to keep them safe and those around them safe. And because that really isn't as accessible, they're in emergency departments, or they're on the street, or they're wherever, and things get exacerbated. Our health system is doing something about that. We've invested in doubling the amount of inpatient beds that we have. We've invested in a lot of outpatient care and services, and a lot of things for our staff, a lot of things for taking care of our staff. So let me turn that into a question, if I may. What have been your observations in terms of the role that compassionate leadership plays in improved mental health for employees?
Well, first of all, I do want to acknowledge that this month is Mental Health Awareness Month. I know that all of us, your listeners as well, we know of many people that are struggling right now. I'm not a mental health expert, but what I will say is that I was one of the first executives 10 years ago to call out the ongoing epidemic of loneliness. And it does concern me. And at that time, I was CEO of Healthways and Tivity Health, later a company that embedded the program Silver Sneakers. And so I dealt with a lot of older adults. And I thought that loneliness was really associated with the older population. Wrong. The younger population are experiencing it in significant levels. And you would think, Tim, that with the, you know, technology that we have, with social media and all of the venues of how you can get connected, that we are now considered the most disconnected generation. And so I don't have an easy remedy here, but what I can say to you, having, you know, researched this for the last 10 years, we have in our foundation a loneliness advisory board, where we have been trying to address how we can bring colleges and senior center facilities together, because we think the intergenerational kind of integration of young and old could address two problems right away. The young people are experiencing that sense of disconnection, and so are the older people. But I like to challenge your listeners that what we can do at very simple steps, we can pick the phone up and call someone that we may not have spoken to in a long time. We can stop by our neighbor. You know, whenever I like, during the pandemic, I learned that I can actually bake. And what I will do is I'll make a pie, and, you know, making one, you know, 2 hours ago before this podcast, if you can believe it. And I'm going to send over a few slices to our neighbors who I know are living by themselves, and to check in on them. We can do simple things to really help bridge this gap that has been occurring. Now, the pandemic clearly put this on steroids. We were already going into the pandemic. The United Kingdom, I think it was in 2016, appointed a minister of loneliness. And a lot of talk show hosts kind of poked fun at it. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is not something to be, you know, poking fun at. This is a serious, and to have the Surgeon General come out with an 81-page report last week was just, in my mind, an applaudable step forward. We need to get the awareness out because a lot of people don't want to admit that they're lonely. Now, why did I attach loneliness to mental health? Because it is a severe association with mental health. That you could have 100 people around you and you feel disconnected. You feel a lost sense of relevancy. And the deeper that continues, the deeper you fall into a serious mental health situation. We don't have enough providers right now to address this. And so I believe that when you get on an elevator, rather than just say hi, why not ask the question, tell me about your day? Why not learn more about your neighbor? When you have a birthday party and you know that your neighbor's across the street all alone, invite them over. And so there are things that we can do that I honestly believe can help to move the needle. We're not going to eliminate this 100% in the next year or two, but we can certainly begin one person at a time.
Yeah, so true. And I know a lot of our listeners are in the healthcare field, if you will, either Northern Light Health in particular, other fields and the like. And, you know, that's a great message for all of us because healthcare has notoriously been, healthcare workers will come to their office or their hospital or their facility and see who's on the list. That means that individual had to take the initiative to come and do that. We need to turn that table and we need to be reaching out and discovering those that are lonely and discovering those that and bring them in, as you say, make them welcome.
One of the things that I do now, I've done it for years, and you know, you may now turn down my dinner invite to you, but every time we have a dinner at the home or we go out to the restaurant, I always ask a question. And it is amazing. You may think you know someone. You may think that because you've been friends with somebody for 25 years that you know everything about them, and you really do not. And by asking the question, you get deeper to understand more about that individual. And I have uncovered individuals who I honestly did not believe they were suffering from loneliness. And quite frankly, they were. A number of years ago, I was invited to speak at the Milken conference. And it was on loneliness. It was probably 16, 17. And there were maybe 500 people in the audience as I was making my speech. And I asked, how many in this audience have ever felt lonely? Tim, how many do you think raised their hands?
Oh, 10%.
Less than that. It was maybe a handful. It wasn't until I said to them, I am CEO of a company. I have a loving partner. I have a loving family and friends. And I'm on boards. And I went on and I said, and I have felt moments of loneliness. Now, when I ask the question, how many of you in this room have had loneliness? The majority of them raised their hands. So we have to, that's why I applaud the Surgeon General. We have to make it okay to be able to say that I have felt lonely. And until we get to that point, the mental health challenges that are before us are going to escalate even further, especially because there are so many issues that we are addressing. The issues today, when I was growing up, they were more local. Today, they're global. In minutes, you hear about a school shooting, or in minutes, you hear about this situation and that situation. And if you don't have anybody to express your feelings, or you feel like nobody really cares about what you're feeling, you could see how you're going to fall into this enormous state of loneliness. So listeners, even if you know someone, even if you think you've had a friend for 35, 40 years, until you ask the question, tell me how you are feeling today. Until you really deeply get into understanding that they might be experiencing loneliness, we're going to have enormous challenges in the next 3 to 5 years. And it scares me to think that this has the potential of getting worse.
Yeah, I really appreciate that correlation, absolutely, between mental health and loneliness. And I believe that especially, again, right now, post the acute stage, if you will, of COVID and the aftermath, if we don't address that and talk about it, it's one of the steps toward destigmatizing mental health and being able to talk about one's feelings. You know, one of my all-time go-to, I say all-time go-to favorites, but only in the last few years, I will say, it's been part of my guiding light, if you will, was Maya Angelou saying, people forget what you said, they'll forget what you did, they'll never forget how you made them feel.
So I love that quote.
I know, right? And I talk about my feelings so much more now than I ever have in my life.
Let me add an example. I think that I think you would enjoy this. In 2014, I was awarded the Robert F. Kennedy Ripple of Hope Award alongside Hillary Clinton and Tony Bennett and Robert De Niro. Don't ask me how I got into that crowd, but it was a very humbling experience. And as I was walking, Hillary had presented her speech at the event. And I was next. And as I was walking up to the podium, I was not going to mention my partner at that time of 25 years. Because as a CEO, you're taught never to share your life. And as I was walking up to the podium, I said to myself, shame on you. You're about ready to receive a human rights award, and you are embarrassed to share a part of your life. And so I stopped the teleprompter and I shared my remarkable life with Jeff and introduced Jeff, and people went crazy in the room. And then afterwards, I had about 200 to 300 of my employees in the room, and about 20 of them ran up to me and they said, thank you for sharing that. We now know you're not boring, you're exciting. And it was so, you know, we're taught to hold back on those very, and that's the vulnerability part that I'm referencing. By the way, people want to know that you are like them. They want to know that you are on the same journey as they are. And I wish I would have known this 50 years ago, because the last 10 years has been such a remarkable freedom for me to know that I don't have to hide a very special part of my life. And you know, this is what I think needs to change. We need to include people of all walks of life. It's what makes our lives interesting. What makes them really dynamic is that sense of inclusion.
Ah, so true. Thank you for sharing that. And, you know, best of wishes and best of love to you and Jeff, that's for sure.
Thank you.
One last question. I know you you touched on this. You interviewed, this is about your book, The Double Bottom Line, How Compassionate Leaders Captivate Hearts and Deliver Results. And you interviewed, you said, a pretty large number of successful leaders who practice compassionate leadership. What are some other takeaways and your experiences that you can share with our audience that really combine with that?
I think what we learned from the 40 plus global leaders that we interviewed is that before you can show someone else compassion, you must take the time to show yourself compassion. And too much of our energy sometimes is not directed toward taking care of ourselves. And taking the time, whether it be to read a book or take the time to, you know, go golfing, whatever it might be, there is too much, you know, of this desire to please, to please, to please, and we get burnt out. And there could be compassionate fatigue. And we warn about that in the book that, you know, you must. And by the way, one of the things that we surprised every leader with, you know, they were given the questions beforehand, is this notion about how do you show yourself compassion? And almost every leader failed. And it was at the end of the interview that they said, we've learned something here today. It's okay to take time for yourself. By the way, I was not good at that. And I didn't realize until I stepped down from my position how exhausted I was running a public company, you know, as a CEO, the demands that are placed on you every single day, yet I continued to handle them. But if I were in New York on business, I would never go and see a Broadway show. How crazy. show yourself compassion, because by showing yourself compassion, you will fill up your energy bank to show others compassion. And we touched upon the other takeaway is that it's not weak leadership. We're not saying that, go out there and, you practice kumbaya and you don't know. We're saying this is a different approach to how you can get to the end point without making a mess. The last point that I will call out is that compassionate leadership can be learned. And I'm not sure that I started off, as a compassionate leader. I am still learning how to do it. And so we challenge all of the people that have picked up the book is to recognize that this can be learned. You can train other people how to be compassionate. And I've been warmed by the by the reality that so many leaders have reached out to us and have thanked us for that. So I think those are some of the key takeaways. There's obviously others in the book as well, I'm sure.
Thank you so much. Are there any other thoughts you'd like to share before we begin to wrap this up?
Yeah, I do want to just share one thing is that, and this is my quote, life is not about doing one great thing. It's about doing little things that have the capacity to drive great change. So many people, and it bothers me when they say this, quite frankly, you had alluded to it in the beginning that, you've had such a great career. I did not map this out. And my goal was not to do, great things. It was to do little things that have the capacity to drive great change. And for all of you who are listening, if each one of us can just do something small, it will have the capacity to drive great change. And in order to do that, we have to practice, this is my word, collaboration. Is that too much of our society is if you're not an innovator, if you don't come up with the idea, people then say you haven't made a contribution. That's rubbish. You must be willing to collaborate, have a little bit of collaboration and a little bit of innovation and be able to marry that with somebody else that might be able to add the missing piece. That will get more done than trying to go about it all by yourself. I would be remiss if I didn't conclude by saying I thank the hundreds and hundreds of perhaps thousands of people that have worked with me in my journey. When I was thinking about the book, I thought only 10 global leaders I would interview because, quite frankly, I didn't think that anybody would say yes to me. Well, over 40 said yes, and they were people that inspired me and individuals who helped me along the way. And so if you're willing to collaborate, you will do those many little things that will drive great change in our society.
Donato Tramonto, thank you so, so much. I really enjoyed this time spent together. Thank you to our podcast listeners as well. I hope you enjoyed this as much as I did. And this is one of those you should listen to a couple of times. Listeners, I'll end with these words that our guest shared, show yourself compassion. On that note, this is Tim Dentry encouraging you to listen and act to promote our culture of caring, diversity, and inclusion. It starts with caring for one another. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Tim Talk. If you enjoyed this podcast, please join us next month for a new episode. There are several ways you can tune into Tim Talk. You can find new episodes on our website at northernlighthealth.org/podcast. We are also on Google, Apple, and Podbean, which makes it easier for you to listen on the go on your favorite app.